Ghost Hunting in New England,
your favorite spooky podcast.
Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to Ghost Hunting in New England with your host Amelia.
And Beth.
And today we are talking about something really cool. But we're only talking about something really cool because we got ghosted.
We were totally ghosted.
Unbelievable. And we are here on a Wednesday night instead of our Thursday. We planned all this stuff out to talk to these people and we got stood up.
Yep. And we're not going to tell you who they are because that would be very unprofessional. But I was just going to say I'm really disappointed because I thought it was going to be a really fun chat that we could have.
Yeah, we thought this was going to be really cool, really sweet people. People we could have looked up to.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Rude. And, I mean, it is October. I know people get busy, but it doesn't take too much to respond to a message and say, you know what? After all, I can't make it.
Nope.
So when you're in a restaurant in the future and you need to leave early, just let your waitress know. Don't just stand up and leave. Just communicate with people.
What? All right. Well, just to be clear, none of this took place in a restaurant, but...
No, none of it. Just, you know, we're talking about manners here.
Yeah. Just whatever. Doesn't matter. And...
Matters to me.
Yeah. Well, whatever. It's fine.
And then... So we're going to do something a little bit different tonight.
We are, and we prepared for it just in case this happened. We had an itch. We had an inkling we might get stood up.
Yeah.
So we prepared. I did a ton of research. I wrote out 7 pages worth of story for you guys on what we're talking about tonight. And then I sent an email and it didn't send. So that's frustrating. But luckily I did all of this research, so I still kind of have my stories memorized, and we're still going to give them to you. So here we go. Oh, we didn't tell them what we were going to do today.
No, we've been kind of like teasing that a little bit.
What are we going to do today, Beth?
We're going to hope that they stop with all the furniture in the next room.
But probably not, because it's Wednesday. That's why no one records here on Wednesdays.
Right.
So what are we doing today?
We have done a little bit of research on cursed Native American burial grounds.
Ooh, spooky.
And we are doing this in honor of Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yeah, so this is a pretty common trope when it comes to ghost hunting or anything dealing with the paranormal, the idea of Native American burial grounds. So we thought we would pick up a couple of them for you.
Can I tell you about a poem that I found?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. In my imagination, when we were... conceptualizing this podcast to start with, I had gone out and I had actually tried to find some literature that really talked about ghosts, like early accounts of ghost stories, whether they were from like the ancient Greeks or the Romans or wherever. And I never quite like got out of my own way and was able to do that. But in my imagination, instead of having like the two of us come in over Aaron's music and say, Ghost Hunting in New England, your favorite spooky podcast, it would have been like a passage from some ancient text about ghost stories. So anyway, I was pretty excited when I found this poem from 1787, which granted is not ancient, but it's definitely about Indian burial grounds. So this poem is by Philip Freneau. He's a Frenchman, and it's called The Indian Burying Ground. Thou stranger that shalt come this way, no fraud upon the dead commit. Observe the swelling turf and say, they do not lie, but here they sit.
Yeah, that's nice. Good poem.
It's so great that it's talking about all the people coming in who are now taking over these Indian lands. They're saying, don't upset the Native American burying grounds, but instead, like, look, the turf swells up because the Native Americans would bury their dead in mounds as opposed to completely under the ground like Europeans would. So you could actually see from a distance, like, oh, that's where their graves are.
Hmm.
So, you know, they do not lie. So they're not flat under the ground, but they're actually like sitting up and watching, which I just thought was so terrific.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. You want to go first this week?
Sure, I'll go first. My memory cave. Here we go.
I'll try not to interrupt too much.
Please don't. This is all coming from memory tonight. Okay, so my first story is on the Spanish Military Hospital in St. Augustine, Florida. It ran as a hospital from 1783 to 1821 during the Second Spanish Period. It housed all kinds of people. Crazy people, people in wars, people hurt, people sick, everything.
I don't think we refer to them as crazy people anymore. I think we refer to them as emotionally disturbed.
Well, I think we actually refer to them as mentally ill. But this was This was in the 1783 to 1821. And they were just crazy.
They would have just been locked in an attic.
Or brought to this hospital. So in 1821, there was an issue with the pipes in St. Augustine. Particularly in this neighborhood, particularly those that had to do with this hospital.
I'm sorry, did you say pipes? Like running water?
Yes.
Okay.
So all the water in the hospital was having trouble going places. There were leaks throughout the city, and it all had to be redone. So what they started doing was tearing down walls to get to all the piping. As they started tearing it down, people, particularly staff members of the hospital, started writing down these accounts of things they were seeing and things they were feeling. Specifically, they kept saying that there was something evil roaming through the building and talking about demonic presences, saying they were hearing sounds that seemed to be coming from nowhere, people screaming, things like that. So as they continued tearing up all of the pipes, they had to go under the building, and this is a very long time ago. So as they were digging, what did they find?
Bones.
Thousands and thousands of bones. And they realized that this was built on a, and I'm not really sure how to say this, and I totally apologize, but I believe it is Timucuan people's land, who had been there sometime before. Thousands, they found mass graves. Later, I believe in the late 1800s, there was another excavation site elsewhere in St. Augustine. They found more mass graves there. So it seems like a lot of that city is just built on top of Native American burial sites. So that hospital actually had to be torn down, but a new one was made to replicate it. So if you go down now and you go, it's still a museum. So you can still go through and see everything how it was back then. But that is actually just as haunted.
Does it come complete with the screaming noises? And
sure does, yes. So the two rooms in particular that are most haunted, the first is the morning room. So the morning room is where they would take people to die. So if you were like on your deathbed, you'd be brought into the morning room. A priest would come in and bless you. Then you would die. You'd cross over. So that was the room that happened in. It's called the morning room. M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. Not morning like, good morning.
Morning like someone died and now you're sad about it.
Yes. So that room is said to have a lot of residual hauntings. So a lot of ghosts that aren't interacting with people. You can hear a lot of screams in that room, a lot of crying in that room, and the most common thing people say they hear is you hear like a distant conversation going on that both sounds right next to you and far away at the exact same time, which we've discussed on the show before. It's a pretty common occurrence. Mm-hmm. The second room that's really haunted is called the ward, and that's where you were prior to entering the morning room. So that's where you're just really sick and in the process of dying, but not yet ready to get blast and turned over.
You're not actively dying at that point.
Aren't we all actively dying?
No. So you know that Fran, being a nurse, she worked in nursing homes, and that's the term for when you are actually on your way to expiring. So you'd be in the morning room for when you're actively dying. Like they know that like the end is coming like right now.
So in the ward, what people hear is they hear all kinds of different sounds. A lot of people say they've seen full-bodied apparitions in this room, and I looked at a bunch of sites, but no one could give me an exact name of the people. There's no account of what it looked like, but a lot of people have claimed to see them. So there you go.
Well, I'd be curious. Are they seeing people who look like hospital staff, or are they seeing full-body apparitions of the Native Americans who are buried beneath the hospital? And I'm sure that was exactly the detail that you were looking for. But
just thought I'd confirm it.
That just seems to be the type of thing that you would include in your details.
So
not you, them, when they're reporting they saw a full body apparition.
So the other big thing that happens in this room is objects are constantly being moved without any kind of explanation. So that would take it away from being a residual haunting into more of a intelligent haunting, which is interesting. And that's what I got on the Spanish military hospital, St. Augustine.
Awesome. I'd be curious about the furniture moving around. Is it going back to a place that it used to be, or do they just come in day by day and the furniture is just in weird new places?
Dunno.
Because if it's being returned to where it started, then maybe old captain from the lighthouse up in Maine is visiting. I liked your story. I like that they kept the old one there as a museum and you could still go and visit. And so people are saying that the museum is still haunted. And do you know where they built the new hospital?
There is no old hospital. That was taken down in 1821.
But didn't you say it's a museum now?
I said they rebuilt a museum to it. That's an exact replica.
Oh, okay.
In the same spot.
In the same, okay.
Yes.
So, all right. And so there's no new hospital that's replaced it.
But that's what makes it interesting is it's still haunted in the same way. And I think the only thing I can think about this, and actually my next story, I have something similar to that that I find very interesting, is that it is so similar that the spirits are kind of still stuck there.
Hmm. Yeah. And they're tied to that spot in the world, not necessarily tied to the building or anything that's there.
Yes.
So now you want to talk about my story?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm going to come at you with a story from Arizona. So Mike from Arizona, if you've been there and you've seen this stuff, we need to know your thoughts on it. So I'm going to talk about the Apache Death Cave. And you know, with a name like the Apache Death Cave, this is going to be a great story. So as I said, it's in Arizona. It's in a town called Two Guns, which is at the intersection of I-40 and Route 66.
I think that this is the place Zach Bagans accidentally took a bunch of mushrooms with his ghost hunting team and they investigated it. I'm not sure. Someone correct me on that. Please feel free to correct me. I think this is the place though.
Does he accidentally take a bunch of mushrooms like Amelia accidentally drinks her coffee?
So they did some like blessing with a shaman before they went on their investigation. And she like gave them, I don't know if it was mushrooms, I might have been like peyote or something, but it's a funny episode.
Okay. All right. So we are going back to 1878 when there was a band of about 40 Apache warriors. They raided this nearby Navajo village and they killed all of the men, women, and children in the village, except for these three young women that they took prisoner, and they burned the village to the ground. So naturally, the Navajo leaders hear about this and they put together a posse of Navajo warriors, like 25 of them, and they send them out to find these Apache warriors and take revenge. So they head off into the desert, the Navajo warriors, and they're tracking the Apaches. And they get word of another Apache raid on another village where all the residents were murdered. Now they have twice as much reason to go and hunt down the Apache tribe that's murdering their people. So they searched out in the desert for weeks, and the Navajo warriors were just about to give up when they feel this strange heat coming off the desert. And I mean, I think that the desert's got to be pretty hot, and there's got to be like hot winds that blow by. But this was so hot that they all stopped and took notice that they were like, this is weird. And they looked around a little bit and they said, aha, we know what's going on here. The Apache had found this big, huge cave, and they had hidden themselves and all of their horses in this cave, and it was their campfire in the cave. The heat of it was coming up out of the cave and washed over the Navajo search party and gave away their location.
How big was that fire?
I don't know. I wasn't there.
It just seems weird to me that the heat of the fire would give it away, not the smoke from the fire. I mean, you're in a desert.
I can certainly see that being a question that I should probably have thought of myself as well.
Hmm.
So the Navajo go off and they plan their revenge. They sneak back and they kill the watchmen who are out as like sentinels for the Apaches. And they pile all of this brush at the mouth of the cave and they start a fire to smoke out or suffocate the Apaches who are hiding inside the cave. The Apaches take their limited water supply and they start trying to put out the fire in order to get out. But of course, they don't have enough water. So then, cover your ears, Amelia. They actually killed all of their horses and tried to use the horses' blood to put out the flames.
It's disgusting.
And they didn't have any luck with that either. So one Apache warrior makes it out. He runs through the fire and he gets out into the front of the cave where he sees all the Navajo warriors standing there like, what are you going to do now? And he begs them for mercy. Please let me live. Let my people in there live. You know, we'll give back all the stuff that we took. And so the Navajo are like, well, all right, you're going to give the stuff back. You know, you seem to be contrite about the whole thing, so we'll let you go. By the way, what happened to those three girls that you took from the first village? And there are some questions that really don't need an answer. And so the Navajo took this guy and threw him back inside the cave and piled the fire higher. I know we have young listeners out there, so I don't want to like detail what the Apache male warriors were using these young girls for. So they pile more fuel back on the fire and just keep the burning going. So it burns for about 2 days before the flames all die down and the screaming from the cave stops. The Navajo warriors go into the cave and they find that the Apaches had taken all of the horse carcasses and built a wall between them and the fire. So there were all these charred horse carcasses, and then behind the wall of horses, there were all of the dead Apache warriors. There were 42 of them there, and they had just suffocated from all the smoke. So after that, neither the Apaches nor the Navajos would use or enter the cave. The prevailing idea going on was that because it was such a terrible death that the Apaches died, that the cave had, you know, been cursed. And that death had not only cursed the cave, but the surrounding land. So we're going to fast forward now about 30 years. And so now Earl and Louise Cundiff buy the property and they build a trading post there because more and more people are going through. So it's right at the intersection of those important roads. And they build a gas station, restaurant, the motel. There's some little rental cottages that people can stay in. And they lease the land out to this guy, Henry Two Gun Miller. He was a con man. He claimed he was an Apache thief called Crazy Thunder. I think that's a great name for anybody. I might start calling my cat Crazy Thunder. And so Henry Miller brings in a Hopi Indian and he has him building some structures to look like prehistoric villages. And he calls this whole area Fort Two Guns. This guy thought it was a really great idea to take the bones of the dead Apaches who are in the cave down below and use them in part of his roadside attraction. He had them like out on display so that people coming by would see them and think that this was a good place to stop. Oops. Yeah, I think generally going in that cave, forget about taking the bones, probably not the best idea. Mm. So in 1926, Two Gun murders Earl Cundiff over a dispute with the lease. He is tried for the murder, but he was never actually convicted of it. He just kind of continued on. In 1930, he gets run out of town by an angry mob because things are just really going kind of nuts at that point. The residents are complaining of a lot of ghostly activity in the city, and they think that it is because he had desecrated the cave and he had taken the bones. He was selling them to people, visitors that came through. I mean, the human body's got, what, 208 bones times 42 people? It's like 8,000 bones. No, that can't be right. Yeah, that should be right. Yeah, it's like 8,000 bones. And so people, you know, complained a lot that they would be walking around, they would hear these moans that would just come from nowhere. There would be footsteps and little footprints that people would see all over the place that weren't caused by anybody going by. There was just a general sense of unease all around the camp. And they had a real problem with fires. Buildings were often and mysteriously just burning down. And two of the bigger fires that happened was in 1934, after Two Gun had been run out of town. Louise Cundiff and her new husband came back and they tried to rebuild the town and get it up on its feet again. And their large trading post that they had built in 1934 burned down again. So time goes on, different people buy in. It goes through a number of different hands. People are trying to rebuild the town. And then in 1971, the entire town caught fire and burned down. And so the only things left standing were the stone structures that the Hopi had built to look like prehistoric areas. The town changed hands a few more times. There were a few more sad stories about people who bought it, who had the idea that they were going to renovate it, they were going to get it going again. And then they died of different kind of causes, killed themselves, or just sudden sort of mysterious deaths. So nothing's really been done there since the town burned down in 1971. Locals who are in the general area warn visitors to stay away from the cave. And they say that anybody who goes out there to the cave is usually scared away before they even go in because they hear the moans of angry spirits coming from the cave. To go just a little bit into your cryptozoology that you love so much, there is supposedly an aswang, A-S-W-A-N-G, that lives in the cave. Have you ever heard of an aswang? Aswang? I'm not sure how you say it.
No.
So it's a shape-shifting, vampire-like creature, half man, half dog. Kind of sounds like a rattlesnake. It has razor-sharp claws, and it sucks unborn fetuses from their mother's womb.
I have heard of this, but I don't remember it being called that.
I'm probably saying it wrong.
But yes, I have heard of it.
Okay. Yeah, that just sounds like a horrible, horrible thing. If you are so interested, you can travel out and visit the Apache Death Cave. Or if you have $3.7 million, you can buy it.
No, thank you.
Russell Crowe currently owns it.
God bless him.
And it's on sale.
Russell Crowe would own that.
So I actually found the listing. And if you bear with me for just 1 second, I will read you the listing because it's kind of funny. So this is 0 East Two Guns Exit in Winslow, Arizona.
I was standing on the corner of Winslow, Arizona. I had to.
That's okay, because apparently that must have been exactly where they were for that song. That's funny.
So my dad's friends, Mike and Kathy, they went to Winslow, Arizona, and there's like a statue for the song. It was like some guy on a corner.
Did they go to the Apache Death Cave?
They did not.
Are you sure?
Yeah, Kathy would have told me.
Okay. Maybe they were so frightened of it, they blocked it out. Anyway, so here's the listing. Own a large piece of Arizona history. Rare development opportunity abounds just east of the now fully operational state-of-the-art Twin Arrows Resort and Casino. Be on the cusp of this growing sector of the state and re-inhabit this lost town rich in history and lore. Property encompasses over 230 acres of level and development-ready land, as well as majestic and sinuous canyonscape. Vestiges of a gas station and other antiquated outbuildings remain, but the setting is ideal for myriad uses from commercial to residential, zone general. Be the new owner to breathe life back into this once wild and colorful town. Phase 1 environmental report previously conducted with gas tanks now closed, and 3-phase power available from nearby substations. $3.7 million, and you could be the proud owner of the Apache Death Cave.
I don't love how they said it was development ready.
It is development ready. It's nice and flat. You don't have to clear the land.
No, I understand that part of it, Beth. What I'm saying is I feel like in 2 years we're going to be like revisiting this. Like they put up a billion condos and now that's haunted.
I know. It would actually be quite comical. If someone were to buy this, put up condos, I would want to go there and talk to all the people that lived in those condos.
Yeah, hopefully they don't do that.
Be like, what freaky stuff happened?
Yeah, hopefully they just let this cave hang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, I had a lot of fun with that one.
Okay, so my next haunted Native American burial site is the Lake Shawnee Amusement Park, which, that name sounds a little bit familiar. It is because last week, Brennan Shea told us he's doing an investigation down there next week.
On October 19th.
Is it October 19th or is it the October 27th event he's doing?
It was October 19th, and I specifically remember because my anniversary is the 20th. That's why I couldn't go on the 19th.
Yeah, so to our West Virginia listeners, you have 3 days to contact Brendan Shea of Serial Spirits and get in on his ghost hunt of the Lake Shawnee Amusement Park. Okay, here we go. I can remember the story.
I won't interrupt.
Thank you. Okay, so our story begins in 19... No, it doesn't. Our story begins in 1775, when the first settler came down to West Virginia. His name was Mitchell Clay. He brought him and his family down, and they decided to build a house and settle right by Lake Shawnee. Now, as tends to kind of happen with American settlers going in, they decide it's their land. Well, there's a problem with that, and that is that the Shawnee people have been living on that land for hundreds of years, and they didn't really ask for a new neighbor. So other settlers follow Clay and his family, they start to come down, and in 1783, Mitchell and some other people decide to go out hunting. Very common for the time. And some of his kids are there with him, but everyone's kind of spread out. You know, you don't hunt. I mean, I've never been hunting, but I assume you don't do it in like a big group. You know, everyone kind of goes out and does their own thing. Unfortunately, some of the Shawnee people were around there and didn't want them hunting on the land. So one of Mitchell's sons, Bartley, got scalped. His daughter, Tabitha, was stabbed and killed. And his oldest son, oh my gosh, I don't have my notes. I can't remember. It's either his oldest son or his youngest son. Anyway, his son, Ezekiel, was captured and they took him to Ohio. Now, I believe this part of West Virginia is very close to what is now Ohio, but I'm going to kind of circle back later as to why they were going to Ohio. So Mitchell Clay and some of the other settlers, they all went and tried to track their son, obviously. And unfortunately, they were a little too late in finding him because he was burned at the stake, which is really sad. Naturally, some revenge took place and the settlers tried to just kill as many of the Shawnee who were involved with this child getting burned at the stake as they could. And it is said that that is when the Shawnee cursed the land of Shawnee Lake. So that happened and it was awful and terrible. And then roll over to 1920. This guy, Snidow, comes in and buys the land. He says, great, got this great land. I'm going to build an amusement park. And that's exactly what he does. So his amusement park has a wooden chair ride on it. You know, those, you know, when you have all the chairs and they're all on the chains and you spin them all around. Fun. My favorite ride. They have a giant Ferris wheel. And then they created a cement pool. And you could go to the, what's it called? Like bathhouse? Yeah, so whatever that's called, bathhouse. And purchase a wool bathing suit for 15 cents and go swimming in their cement pond. So that's kind of interesting. I wouldn't mind going swimming in wool, but so that was going on for a while and everyone was really happy. It became really popular. There was a dance hall on the property of the amusement park. There was a speakeasy in the amusement park. This is a time of prohibition. But unfortunately, there were some other incidents that went on there. So the first was a young boy died in the lake, which wasn't meant for swimming. People at the amusement park were not supposed to be swimming there, but this boy, I presume, wandered off and drowned in the lake, which is tragic. Another young boy drowned in the swimming pool, the cement swimming pool. And then what closed down the park was the death of a young girl. So she was on the swings, the rotating swings. And so she was on the rotating swings, and all of a sudden, a truck making deliveries at the amusement park was backing up and backed into the ride and killed the girl. And it was this huge, huge story. And it ended up closing the park down. Now, I thought that was kind of interesting because I'm like, oh, two boys and a girl, just like the children of Mitchell Clay who passed away. Two boys and a girl. But as I continued to research, there were also three other deaths responsible at the park, but no one's been able to, there's no account of who they are. And this was a long time ago, in the early 1920s, so in West Virginia, so I don't know. I couldn't find any information, but everyone says there were six deaths that happened at that park. So it got closed down. All the equipment was sold. All the rides were sold. Everything was gone. Then in the 1980s, this guy Gaylord White purchased the land. Now, Gaylord had worked at the park in his youth and loved it and thought it was just great. So he wanted to recreate the park in all of its glory. Including he wanted to do another chair spin ride. He wanted a Ferris wheel back. And then he wanted to add like little kiddie rides, like rides for small children. And in the pond, he put bumper boats. So those were his big things. He built a giant stage. Now, every good ghost story has a bit of coincidence in it, right? So as they're going and they're trying to find all this equipment for their park, they find a spinning chair ride for sale in New Jersey. So they drive up to New Jersey, they pick it up, they bring it back down. They run the serial number. It's the exact same one that the little girl had died on at the park before. And that was very interesting. And they thought it was wild and what a strange coincidence. And they kept it. And apparently this park was very, very popular. So they said, I believe, and again, I don't have my notes, I'm so sorry, but I believe in 1987, they had a $1 admission day or $1 admission weekend for 4th of July that year. And they said over 10,000 people came through. And they had bands playing 24 hours on a stage. It was like this great party. It was like the biggest thing in West Virginia at that time. But as what happens to a lot of small businesses, the insurance on keeping the park alive was astronomical, and unfortunately they had to close. So they closed that. They decided to turn their land into like a fishing outing thing for people. So they do that kind of stuff. And they're clearing out some of the land. They're thinking about putting in development. They're not sure what they want to do with it. Clearing some of the land. They start finding artifacts. So they find arrowheads. They find pots. They find all kinds of stuff. And they go, well, this is a lot of stuff and it's interesting. So we should call some people. So I believe they called a university. I believe it's called Marshall University.
We are Marshall.
What?
We are Marshall. They had a plane crash, killed like their whole football team, I want to say.
Oh, that's tragic.
Yeah.
That's awful. They came in and they spent years on the property uncovering all these artifacts. And what else do they find? A child cemetery. Yes. So, remember what I said about everyone trying to go to Ohio? What they suspect happened was the settlers brought a flu in that ran like wildfire through the Shawnee peoples and began killing off all the children and all the elderly, because that's a lot of what they found there. That's why they were all trying to go to Ohio. They were trying to kind of get away from whatever was going on. There's an estimated 3,000 bodies buried at this cemetery. Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot. Okay, so they find that out. And then they start doing some paranormal events at night and things like that. And they open up to investigations because a lot of crazy stuff has happened. The first is that Gaylord White, the guy who bought it in the 1980s, claimed to have seen a ghost there. So he was out on his tractor, and he said when he was on a tractor, he felt this heaviness on his shoulders. It was happening a few nights in a row. And then he decided to turn around and look one day. And all of a sudden, out of thin air, a young girl in a white ruffled dress appears with blood all over her dress. Just stares at him. He said he wasn't afraid, but he said, well, if you like my tractor so much, you can have it. And he got off the tractor and he went inside, and that tractor was still there on the property, not touched, not moved, well into the 1990s. So not scared at all. One of his sons, Gaylord White II, also said he saw that girl one day and that she was just staring at him. And while she was staring at him, he couldn't move. He like had paralysis, just could not move. Wearing the same exact thing. Some other paranormal investigators also say they've seen this young girl also just staring at them. A lot of TV shows. This is one of the most haunted places in America. So a lot of TV shows have been there. The Discovery Channel, when they went, a woman got stuck in the bathhouse or a ticket booth. I believe it was a ticket booth that had a push door, and she was pushing on it. This door had no lock and she could not get out of it. And she was very upset, very panicked. They finally got her out because they heard her screaming. And she had to be rushed to the nearby hospital in Princeton because she was so panicked and just out of it that she actually had to be hospitalized, which is wild. They say on the swings, you can see swings moving. Gaylord White passed away and Gaylord II passed away. And now Chris Gaylord and his mother and I think one of their other siblings own the park now. Mrs. White said that they have video, like surveillance video, of one of the latches on the Ferris wheel, like opening and closing on its own with no one around. And she says she knows that's her husband, and he's still there because he always would check the latches. And it's like a thing to her to let her know he's okay. And then Gaylord II also passed away, I would say in 2013. And she said that a photo was taken that appears to have his apparition on a bus that he often worked on the property. And that's the story.
Neat.
Yeah. So what do you think of that one?
There was a lot going on in there.
Yeah.
I had to do a lot to not interrupt as you like went through the whole thing. Starting back with the Mitchell Clay family that they went in. One of the things that immediately came to mind, having been exposed to a lot of different versions of history, I actually wonder how much of what happened to his family was legitimately true. Like, did his son really get scalped? What happened to the daughter? She was stabbed?
She was stabbed.
And then the other son burned at the stake. I just wonder how much of that really happened versus how much of it was, just kind of put out there as a story in order to vilify the Native Americans, the Shawnee people.
Well, they had already moved out by that point. That's okay. Why they got him in Ohio.
Well, But they had left because of the flu that came in and was making them all sick?
Presumably. I'm not totally sure.
Okay. Well, it just, I try to take with a grain of salt, especially in 1775, where there would have been a lot of hostility by them, but it wasn't really until the 1820s and 30s that it got like nasty violent with the Trail of Tears and,
That's separate.
Well, yeah, but it's stories like this about, my family, I had a kid get scalped and somebody else got stabbed and then my third kid was burned at the stake would have been fodder for, this is why the savages can't live here anymore. We have to get rid of them. So that's just kind of like that was my gut reaction to that was, questioning whether or not, well, did that stuff really happen? Because it was an ongoing truth that people would make up these stories in order to make the Native Americans seem like less than human.
No, I would believe that all that happened. Yeah. I mean, these people came and moved into their land and now they're hunting in their locations and you don't know what the kids might have done or what the parents might have done before that. I mean, we don't have a before story.
Right. We don't know what kind of interactions or negotiations took place before that. But then the idea of the boy being burned at the stake, all I could think was Melisandre and the Lord of Light, which doesn't mean anything to you. But I bet a lot of our listeners will remember when Stannis Baratheon's daughter was burned for their god. It's a Game of Thrones thing. I know your dad's been trying to get you to watch it, but...
Not my cup of tea.
Okay. You've never seen it. How do you know it's not your cup of tea? Besides...
I watch one with my dad.
Who doesn't like a show that's all boobs and dragons?
Me.
Whatever. You did a good job. With the sparsity of your notes here, you did a really good job telling that story.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. Spent a lot of time on it researching all 5 pages of notes I took.
Well, it clearly stuck. I'm not even kidding. Like, she has, like, Mitchell Clay, 1775.
I have 5 lines of notes that I scribbled down like, 2 minutes before we started.
Yeah, she's not even exaggerating. It says, like, 1920. Might say widow. Snidow.
That's when Snidow bought it.
And in 1966, closed death. Like these were some pretty impressive notes just to jog her memory. So well done.
Thanks. Okay. So do we have anything else for this week?
Do we have any reviews?
We got a lot of reviews, but no one left us any comments.
No comments.
Have a look at this.
I really did like that giant koala that he sent us, that video. I thought that was a riot. On the topic of manifesting, in which I include poltergeists, as they are usually found to occur when a preteen or teen is around, and only happens when they're around and is often focused on one or both of the parents that they may have had issues with, my now adult daughter and a few of her friends were talking about ghosts one evening, and I was offering my experiences and the logical debunking of many through a scientific process, when I started to feel a weird sensation that someone was standing next to me and was sucking energy from me. This would be okay if it was in an empty old haunted house, but it was in a brand new house in a new suburb on what used to be a stock paddock. I was standing with my back to a curtained window and all the others in the room sitting on the floor facing me. Initially, I thought the feeling was just because of the subject we were discussing, but then I noticed that as we were talking, my daughter would make furtive glances to my right as if looking at something. After a few minutes of this, I stopped talking and asked her to stop that. Others asked what she was doing, and I replied that she was manifesting a fake spirit just to the right of me. Others exclaimed in surprise as they also saw the darker silhouette next to me, but assumed only they could see it, and that it was possibly an after effect of looking at me and then to the mostly empty curtain behind me as I was to one side of the window. I said, no, it's my daughter manifesting the entity by drawing energy, mostly from me. Nothing sinister, it was only a low-energy representation of her imagination drawn from the subject matter, and using the energy of those in the room. I mentioned how in many cases of ghosts, it is just a person's imagination being turned into a semi-real entity through their own energy. Young people are more prone and capable of it, as they haven't had years of people telling them ghosts are not real.
Daniel has a daughter?
And apparently she has friends.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And Daniel's daughter can draw energy off of Daniel to manifest a ghost right next to him.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Daniel sends such great stories. So Daniel, I mean, you know this, but that was the last one from that big long thesis that you sent us back in, hang on, I'm scrolling, on August 1st. It has taken since August 1st for us to read through all of these stories.
And we have another email in them there from him too.
I know, and I think there's only one story in that one.
Yeah.
So get on it, man. Send us more.
Yeah, and everyone else, please feel free to send us more to ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com. We love reading them and sharing them with everybody.
And we'll especially love it if it's your voice and not my gravelly Boston accent doing it.
Okay, so is that all we got for this week, Beth?
I think so. Are you sure we didn't have a Facebook review?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's all I have.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. As always, thank you to Aaron Schilb for doing all of our music. You guys can find us on Facebook or Instagram at Ghost Hunting in New England, on Twitter, Ghost Hunting NE. Send us an email, ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com, or a carrier pigeon to Somerville Media Center. Thank you guys so much for listening, as always, and
happy hunting.